you for standing by, and welcome to the Star Entertainment Group FY 2021 Results Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Matt Bekier, MD and CEO. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our results presentation for FY 2020-21. Let me start by touching on the highlights of this past very interesting year. They're set out on page 4 of the presentation that we put up on the ASX. Obviously, trading last year was heavily impacted by COVID restrictions. Despite these constraints, we posted a respectable normalized EBITDA of $430 million, and statutory NPAT after all cost and abnormal expenses of $58 million. There is no dividend this year as we need to de-gear the company further. What should give you as investors comfort in these results is how robust the business is when restrictions are lifted. You see that graphically on page 6 where we track revenue throughout the year. The best proxy for what the business can do in a more normal environment is the Gold Coast, where domestic revenues set an all-time record high in the second half, up 18% on 2019, which was the last non-COVID interrupted year. And we did that without any new assets in operation. Given the operating leverage in our business and the focus on cost control, this has generated record earnings of $112 million in the Gold Coast, which we've set out on page number 9. Despite an absence of international business, no conventions, interruptions in trade, and little interstate traffic, particularly around peak periods such as Easter. It clearly demonstrates that our confidence in the Gold Coast market is warranted and that the investments we have made are generating good returns. The announcement around the Olympics earlier this year is another further aspect that gives us confidence in our investments in SEQ. The recovery in Sydney has been a bit slower due to the restrictions coming off later, as shown on page 8. It was pleasing, though, to see how the loyalty customer base performed throughout the year and that casual customer visitation responded well to marketing when we turned it on. Our cost management was effective. We implemented the last leg of our fixed cost reduction program and our margins improved to over 27% of EBITDA, also partly because of the absence of the low margin international business. We generated good cash on the back of lower capex. We reduced debt by $211 million, and we materially improved the state of the balance sheet in terms of liquidity and gearing. Our expansion projects in Brisbane and the Gold Coast are now all off balance sheet from here on, with appropriate project funding in place. The major effort, Queen's Wharf, has now been de-risked by continued lump sum tendering, which has reached more than 90% of the total contract sum. The project now looks like opening in stages in about a year and a half. I will now ask Harry to take you through the financials.
Great, thanks Matt. Look, I'll briefly touch on the key points on costs, capex, balance sheet and asset sales. Firstly on costs, as Matt said, we managed costs well in what was a pretty unique environment in FY21 with OPEX for the year down 30% on FY19 levels, so a very significant decline. The cost focus was in the year was twofold. Firstly, we tactically adjusted costs to address the short-term impacts of COVID. As restrictions eased over the year, those short-term or tactical reductions have incrementally come back into each property, but in line with the revenue improvement that we've seen over the course of the year. Secondly, we've also at the same time been running the fixed cost or overhead reduction program we've previously updated the market on, which is targeting $50 million in permanent cost reductions. That program was well progressed over 21 and the full benefits we expect are in place this financial year. The lockdowns we experienced in the second half started to have more limited notice as the year went on and so it did get more difficult to tactically respond to those restrictions when new COVID restrictions were put in place. But overall, you know, given the challenges, we've continued to manage the cost base well and advanced the restructuring opportunities we wanted to do to continue to provide or to drive improved efficiencies in the business. Secondly, on CapEx and balance sheet, CapEx was only $96 million in the year, even when we include the software as a service investment we made in the year, which is the lowest level the company's had since it was established in 2011. The JV contributions were $118 million in the year, but are now reducing very significantly with Tower 1 on the Gold Coast and Queens Wharf contributions complete and those projects now funded by asset-level debt. Looking forward, we're now in a position, as we've said before, that we can see CapEx stay comfortably below D&A for the foreseeable future, and we're confident that makes sense because we've just completed very significant investments in Sydney and the Gold Coast, and you can see just how significant that investment program's been in the last 6 years on the chart on slide 15. As Matt said, our liquidity position's strong. We have $424 million of undrawn facilities at the end of the financial year and no facilities maturing in the next 12 months. COVID's clearly impacting earnings with Sydney closed in the early part of FY22, but the fact we repaid over $200 million of debt in the last year and the strong liquidity position we have positions us well to deal with that lockdown. Lastly, on asset sales, look, we're pushing on with a number of the asset sales we previously talked about, which will further assist the balance sheet. We're in the process of selling our second VIP jet, and we're also in due diligence for the sale of our interest in the Treasury buildings in Brisbane. Those two processes are well advanced now, and we're looking to have both executed in this half. In addition, we've also initiated a formal process to explore the sale and leaseback of the Star Sydney property. We talked about the potential value benefits of the sale and leaseback of the portfolio as part of our merger proposal with Crown. But we think where cap rates are, there's an opportunity to enhance value for shareholders through monetizing the property portfolio. On that basis, we've decided to push forward with the process on the Star Sydney in the first instance, but obviously we could add the Queensland properties to that vehicle down the track as well. We've started the expression of interest process and have had good interest so far, and we're going to continue to progress that process and provide more colour on the terms and an update to the market over the course of this financial year. So that was all I wanted to say in terms of summary points on the financials. I'll hand back to Matt.
Thank you, Harry. So that was last year. This year, we're once again impacted by COVID closures. In Sydney, we've been closed all year, and in Queensland, we have intermittent closures and some restrictions are continuing as we speak, so the outlook is a bit more positive. The pattern of trading and the customer response that we're seeing is the same as last year, but it's fair to say that there's probably a bit more caution that we're seeing this time around, with the bounce back being a bit slower than we've experienced it before. Just think that people are still a bit nervous about how much infection is around and holding back with going out. In these difficult times, we continue to support our staff by making top-up payments. So for the bulk of the staff that we've stood down, they can participate in the government emergency payments. We then top them up to about 80% of pre-COVID payments. All of the corporate staff, including the management team and the board, have taken a 20% pay cut, so everybody's running at about 80% of expenses, of income, and our expenses have come down. We have to be mindful that in hospitality we're experiencing extreme staff shortages, so us making top-up payments and looking after our staff is really just making sure that we don't lose all our staff as we hopefully open up very soon and then expand in Queensland. In terms of priorities and outlook, I refer you to page 20 of the presentation. I hope the themes will look familiar, but let me highlight a couple of things. On operating expenses, we feel we've established a fixed cost base that is lean. From here on, we're not really focusing on taking on out any more fixed costs. We just want to stay with this lean fixed cost base and then scale up as volume comes back. One area where we are investing, however, is resources around regulatory and compliance, with particular focus on AML and CTF and responsible gaming. We've made significant investments in the space over the last couple of years. We've made very good progress, but the bar continues to rise, and so our performance has to keep up with that. On Crown, you will have probably followed the activity. As you know, we put forward an offer to merge with Crown in May and withdrew it last month when revelations from the Royal Commissions in Victoria and WA cast doubt on the sort of future earnings potential. And we felt that our offer was too rich in that context. But the basic tenet of our proposal still holds true, and that is, you know, creating a lean, compliant, capitalized Australian integrated resource operator of a scale that will be able to compete globally for when tourism and returns in the next 12 to 18 months. We think that is a very attractive destination, and we continue to believe that there's a lot of merit in that. So while we await the results of those Royal Commissions, we shore up our own position by progressing the sale and leaseback of our properties, as Harry has mentioned, with an initial focus in Sydney, and progressing our own property clearance in all of the relevant jurisdictions. Finally, the development projects in Queensland are now coming closer to completion. This year we'll open the third hotel on the Gold Coast with some associated food and beverage, and then the fourth hotel is about two and a half years after that. In the second half of next financial year, we expect to start opening up Star Brisbane and Queen's Wharf. This is a few months later than we had previously indicated, and we are currently in the process of working through the precise timing, opening sequence, and consequences of the change schedule. Both projects, both Queen's Wharf as well as the expansion in the Gold Coast, remain on budget, which of course is very pleasing. So that's what we'll focus on this year, and this is where I finish our commentary, but we're happy to take any questions you might take. Over to you, operator.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Larry Gandler with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to hear you, Matt. It's been a while. Obviously suffering through lockdowns.
It's always moving to me, Larry.
Thanks. Likewise, Matt. Matt, I want to ask about the Sydney sale and leaseback, the OpCo, PropCo. Just wondering if you could put some more color on it, particularly as you think about structuring it. How would you structure sort of rent, you know, what percentage of EBITDA would be adequate for rent, you know, looking at some of the U.S. REITs, casino REITs there, there's, you know, generally 3x coverage. I don't know if that's a model for you. If you can kind of put some color on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, look, I'll let Harry talk to the specifics, but you're right that the U.S. model is a very good proxy for where we want to go with that. And, you know, in the past, we've looked at that, and when we had, you know, 20% of our earnings coming out of VIP, the volatility of those earnings and the uncertainty whether you're going to make a massive win or massive loss made the whole proposition a lot more challenging. Now that I think the future looks a lot more stable and less volatile, the whole OpCo-PropCo model looks a lot more like the U.S. model, which is appealing.
Yeah, and look, Larry, obviously sort of as we advance the process, we'll be in a better position to talk more specifically to terms, but I'd probably point you to the slide we did when we put the proposal forward with Crown, and we put some metrics around the sort of model we thought made sense, both in terms of rent coverage and what sort of proportion of ownership we would retain. Yeah, that's still our current thinking, but obviously sort of as we go through the process, we'll define the terms and be in a better place to be more specific on them.
Okay, great. So essentially the thinking in that slide actually does pertain to your thinking in Sydney is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the model we think, you know, in this market makes sense in terms of the OpCo, PropCo, in terms of getting the regulatory approvals, but also getting the right sort of value outcome for shareholders.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Desmond Tsao with Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Matt. Good morning, Harry. Can you guys hear me clearly?
Yep.
Awesome. Yeah, maybe just first question around Queensland. You know, as you guys mentioned, very strong result, particularly in Gold Coast, where I think slots look to be north of 20% growth versus 2019 levels. Just maybe talk to the drivers between the two Queensland assets and absent lockdowns, you know, where do you see margins trending to? You know, I know obviously VIP is low on margin and at some point in time that will come back, but is there any reason why these record margins through these assets can't be sustained or further improved?
Look, in terms of the difference between the assets, I would say you know that in Brisbane we are just constrained in terms of space, and so there's very little you can do within the heritage walls of the old property to drive further slots revenue. In fact, what we've been doing over the last 12 months, we've been pulling slot machines off the floor and been putting more tables onto the floor because, you know, if you think ahead to Queen's Wharf, I'm very confident that when you have, you know, the 2,500 slot machines on the bigger floor plate, that will, you know, that will pop. We know that the slots market is there and that the slots players are there. But because Treasury used to be so small, it's been difficult to actually satisfy the demand for table games in Brisbane. And so we've been deliberately pushing the table games business through a number of initiatives. And it's going well, and it's exciting to see that we're bringing new players onto the table in fun ways. So that means that the more the real growth potential and the real sort of yardstick of how good the business can be is the Gold Coast, as you pointed out. In the Gold Coast, we've got space. We can do, you know, we've got private gaming rooms of a very high quality. And a lot of the growth that we've seen in the Gold Coast has been at the higher tiers of our loyalty base. That's just been able, we've been able with the assets and the investments that we've made, penetrate these sort of customer segments that in the past, which is, you know, there wasn't enough of a differentiation between us and some of the other pubs and clubs, particularly some of the better clubs. In terms of the margins, yes, we've made a big step up.
Yeah, look, probably just one thing to call out is the first half in Brisbane, you sort of had a really strong margin, but it was assisted by the JobKeeper subsidy. But when we look into the second half, Gold Coast had of all of our properties, probably the most normal operating environment. Yeah. We hardly, we didn't really get impacted, no lockdowns other than the last day of the financial year and more limited sort of changes to the social distancing restrictions. And most of the half, not quite all of it, the domestic borders opened to the sort of major domestic tourism market. So Gold Coast sort of had probably the best run in terms of restrictions. So it is a more normal second half, and Brisbane, obviously, first half's a bit abnormal because of JobKeeper, and then second half's, there's a little bit of inefficiency because we had, you know, 2-3-day lockdown periods and an extra day at the end. So, you know, the second half's indicative of normal margins broadly if you sort of exclude a couple of those items I referenced.
That's great. Very helpful. And then second question, you know, with respect to the proposal for an additional 1,000 slots in New South Wales, appreciate its early days, but perhaps if you can give us a guide on, you know, the potential timing of this likely structure and why you see yourself as well placed to achieve this, you know, to what extent is the scale of your balance sheet and I guess ability to manage responsible gambling favouring you guys?
Look, there's the number of slots here in New South Wales in Sydney at Star has always been a bit of an anomaly. Crown's got over 2,500 slot machines in Melbourne. There's 2,500 slot machines essentially in Perth. Queen's Wharf will have 2,500 slot machines. And in Sydney, we've got 1,500 in the deepest market in the country. So we have been talking to government for a little while about normalising that. The proposal that we have taken to government that is now getting good traction is essentially saying let us participate in a buyback and leaseback scheme that would move machines out of more difficult areas into the casino. And I think the government is recognizing that the work that we've done around RG, the amount of control they have by having all of these machines in one location, the amount of tax that they can that we can generate here with these machines, they all, you know, are in favor of putting more product into our casino. And if we participate in the buyback scheme, it reduces the total number of machines in the market even further, which is attractive to the government as well. Now, the negotiations we expect to start pretty quickly. I don't think that that will take very long. I hope that this calendar year, all of this will be resolved. The biggest issue that we need to run down is just, you know, what conditions are being attached to any of the product that comes across, and then we will acquire the product on market. And you know what these machines trade at, so financially that should not be a burden. We would not be putting 1,000 machines on straight away. Right? We would anticipate that we would have a much more gradual way of increasing the floor plate and adding additional product.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thanks for the additional color. Okay. Thanks, Matt and Harry. I'll jump back in the queue and let someone else have a go.
Just on the slots, let me add one more thing. You know, with the Southern Room expansion and some of the other expansionary projects that we've done, a lot of the heavy lifting from a structural point of view has been done here at Star. We have a lot of space available to, you know, to now just fit out and put this additional product in. And that's attractive for us. So we don't need to build additional buildings and towers to get the product in.
Got it. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Sasha Crean with Evans & Partners. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Matt and Harry. Just a couple more questions on the potential sale and leaseback in Sydney. Can you maybe make a comment on what your cap rate expectations are and where you think casino rent will sit in the spectrum of various REIT cap rates?
Look, Sasha, it's sort of, given it's a competitive process, it's probably not in a position to be specific. But I think when we talked about it at the time we did the merger proposal with Crown, we provided some benchmarks, right? And some of the various non-casino asset REITs were sort of in the fours to mid-fives range. Some of the US casino REITs have been higher than that, but coming down over time. They're probably your benchmarks. You know, obviously we're focused on running a process to get as attractive a cap rate as possible, but, you know, at this part of the process, we're not going to be specific on our expectations.
It's fair to say that the findings that we have are positive. So we have not been disappointed in our expectations.
And just in terms of regulatory approval processes, obviously any issues there? Is it fairly straightforward?
Well, it hasn't been done, so I don't know whether it's fairly straightforward, but we've initiated the discussions here in Sydney. And in Queensland, we don't anticipate, you know, problems that can't be overcome. We obviously have to work with the regulator to advance this issue. We don't anticipate that these are issues that can't be overcome.
Yep. Okay. And then one more for me, just in terms of, I think New South Wales has announced that they're going to be implementing all of the recommendations from the Bergen report. I know we spoke about this last result, but can you maybe just comment on any expectations around revenue or cost impacts from those recommendations?
Probably a little bit too early because we don't know what specific implications will flow from that. The one that, you know, is probably the most significant one is the ban on junkets. And so that line of business will go to zero. But it's been zero for the last 12 months pretty much, so, you know what that looks like.
Yeah. And just you mentioned increased investment in risk and compliance. Is there any offset to that $50 million of saving that you've been speaking to from that investment?
It's different, right? So think of the $50 million as if you took a first half 20 run rate, which was the last pre-COVID affected period, that on the same level of volumes, we're making sort of $50 million of cost savings. Obviously, then some areas will increase from there as we make investments in certain areas. They're sort of not really connected, Sasha. But I would say as well, we've put a lot of investment in technology in this space. So it's not just, you know, cost in terms of people, because we think the best outcome here is really leveraging technology. We've got a new transaction monitoring system that's in place that really positions us very well to leverage technology as well to improve our capability in as efficient way as possible, but there will obviously be other costs that are invested in that area as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Simon Thackray with Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Matt. Good morning, Harry. I just want to actually carry on from Sasha's question again, just on costs. Just in terms of the fixed cost program, which is the $50 million, which is, you know, near enough complete, which is about $1 million a week, just the first of all, Harry, the allocation of those costs to each property, given your comments about the technology system and observing the margin performance, I'm just trying to understand where the bulk of what the allocation of costs are across the three properties.
Look, it's not far off the sort of 60-20-20 split that generally we allocate corporate costs on, probably a little bit, and 60 for Sydney, 20 for each of the Queensland properties, probably slightly more skewed to Sydney, but, you know, so bulk is in Sydney, but it does impact the Queensland properties as well.
Right. Terrific. And then just leading on from that, I mean, obviously your situation's been a little bit more unique than some of the other companies I cover in different industries. In terms of evidence of any inflation in any area that may impact your expectation for costs going forward when we get back to normal, whenever that is?
Look, there's a bit of wage inflation coming in different areas, not necessarily across the board. I think everyone's talked about insurance, you know, D&O insurance has been escalating insurance. So some of those sort of corporate cost categories, I'd say we're probably exposed similarly to other listed players, but not calling out anything sort of over and above that. You've got to remember, Simon, our main cost is people, right? So 60% of the operating costs are staff, so that's generally where your sort of main inflation category is. And most of our staff are on enterprise agreements, which have sort of fixed rates locked in for escalation every year. So there's no major changes to historic rates on that.
No, that's helpful. And then just a follow-up question on QWB and just the phasing for the opening. Noting that that's no longer at the expectation at the end of calendar year 22 and into the first half of calendar year 23. Appreciate that just means Treasury's open for longer and sort of nets out. But is there any actual delay, or is it just a rescheduling on program?
We've been notified by Multiplex Monday last week. We're up a new program. We're working through the details of that program. It's in everybody's interest to open this thing as soon as possible. We are, you know, ready and keen to go. I know the state is keen for us to open up as soon as possible. So we're very focused in understanding what we can do and when at this point. And as soon as we've got greater clarity, we'll let you know. Your observation about the financial impact is right. You know, having 100% of the treasury earnings at this level is attractive, and of course, there's liquidated damages.
Fantastic. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Rowan Sundram with MST Financial. Please go ahead.
Morning, Matt and Harry. Just a couple from me on the regulatory front. Firstly, can I ask, are you any wiser on the AUSTRAC notice? Have you had any dialogue from them since?
We've had dialogue with the compliance division. We've had a heads up from the enforcement division that action is going to be taken, but we've not yet received any requests for material.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you. And with the news that we could be looking at a new New South Wales regulator, does that change anything? Are there any implications from that, or is it business as usual for Star?
Look, for the time being, it's business as usual. Obviously, we'll have to see what the implementation looks like. You may recall that we put a submission to Bergen that was supportive of a dedicated casino regulator because we felt that, you know, the current setup where you had, you know, casinos sort of be, as part of the wider portfolio that liquor and gaming has to look after was just very, very challenging because the issues that we were dealing with were quite different. So we are supportive. We're very keen to see that come through, and I think it'll be a positive outcome.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Fabris with Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Matt. Good morning, Harry. I just wanted to circle back on a few things that have been discussed. And I think, you know, if we think about the value creation possibility with Treasury and then the Star Sydney, how are you thinking about the timing of those two finalising? And then if we think about sale proceeds, do you keep them to deleverage or do you retain them to support future M&A or growth developments, or would you look to return them to shareholders through possibly buybacks?
Look, so the Treasury, we're looking at a sale documents being signed this half. It's probably going to be completed in two stages, though, because we can complete some of the non-casino assets sooner, but you're probably not completing the transaction on the asset that has the casino until you move into Queen's Wharf. So you probably get some proceeds this year and maybe some the following year. And then, look, the sale and lease back, we've just got to sort of get through the process a bit longer, but with the regulatory approval process, probably in terms of receiving proceeds, you know, it's unlikely to be this financial year, probably next one, or if it is this financial year, it'd be sort of back end. Look, use of proceeds, David, I think we just got to assess at the time what's the highest and best use of proceeds for shareholders. So I think ultimately your backstop's capital management, but if there are high-returning investments that we can put the capital to that are going to deliver higher returns for shareholders, we'd prioritise those.
I would just say, David, though, you know, we haven't been adventurous on that front, and you shouldn't assume that we will be in the future, right? So the whole notion of capital light is now coming very much into focus. You know, I am personally delighted at the prospect of releasing potentially billions through the sale and lease back. I think the fact that all of the major property developments, all of the major developments here are off balance sheet should give you a bit of an indication of how we think about, you know, some, how we want to do the growth investments. You know, that, and if you look at finally this, the fact that we're starting to get into a very cash generative position because where our CapEx is coming off now, DNA is well above our organic CapEx requirements. And as soon as Queen's Wharf opens up and the market normalizes, we'll be generating a lot of cash. And we've worked very hard to get our cost base right and to get our margins right to generate that cash. I think the board and we're all very mindful of the fact that our investors haven't had a dividend for a while. And, you know, that's very high up on the list.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. And just another question. With a lot of talk around regulatory change in the industry, have you sort of thought about what cashless could mean for volumes in the domestic business? Would it be a negative impact? And then secondly to that, just thinking about, you know, understanding source of funds or source of wealth, will you guys need to undertake a customer review as well, or is that something you're already dynamically doing?
So on the source of funds,
more broadly on all of those regulatory issues, you know, the government has provided a policy position, but we haven't actually got an understanding yet of what that means in practice. The source of funds, to some extent, we do that already because, you know, we need to do background checks and understand where our customers come from at different tiers of our loyalty base and to get them access to our private gaming rooms. So we'll have to see what else we need to do. It doesn't really worry me too much because if a customer doesn't want to tell us what the source of fund is, then we really don't want to have them as a customer anyway. So that's okay. And then cashless is another one of those things that I just don't think is as big a deal as some of our competitors are making this out to be. I mean, if I observe the way our customers are behaving, particularly now post-COVID, nobody's touching cash if they can help it. And everybody's tapping and using electronic funds transfers. So if we can find a technology solution that makes it easy to use and comfortable, I think we can bring all of the customers there pretty quickly. I just want to be mindful of not alienating our customers and not forcing them to do something that they're unwilling or unable of doing. But I'm a big believer in, you know, taking this business into the 21st century. And, you know, part of that has to be that regulation gets modified. You know, right now, by law, we're not allowed to accept debit cards or credit cards. Obviously, if you want to go cashless, we need to modify some of those things. But I think it's a good thing.
Gotcha, that makes sense. Look, I've got one last question. Just around the possible increased slots in Sydney, I was wondering, was that an exclusive negotiation? And how did it come about? Did you guys approach the government or did the government come to you regarding that?
Look, I don't want to go through the ins and outs, but you can assume that government was not sitting around and saying, how can we get this done? So this is something that was initiated from our end.
Yeah, and when we think about that, even with these additional entitlements, does it put any risk that maybe Crown Sydney or an operator of Crown Sydney could potentially get slots before that 20-year exclusivity period expires?
I don't see how that's connected. We have Harry's done, as part of the tax arrangement, we've got very clear arrangements with governments around exclusivity in a casino environment, and that's not being changed by changing the number of slot machines that we can or can't have. It's an anomaly. You know that, David. You know, we've got 1,500 machines. It's a very small number given the size of the market, and all we're doing is we're participating in a buyback scheme to, over time, bring that number more into line with what a competitive large property should have. So I don't think that that's such a difficult thing.
No, I agree. It'd be a great outcome if it comes through. So appreciate you taking my questions and I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Matt Ryan with Barrenjoey. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I just had a question on the balance sheet. We can obviously see the liquidity position and you've given some useful colour on obviously where the balance sheet is at and the impact of Sydney. Just curious whether you can share any thoughts or colour around your conversations with the actual debt holders at the moment and sort of how they're feeling about the next 6 to 12 months.
We're sort of obviously in active dialogue with our lenders, Matt, and we'll sort of point to last year where, you know, obviously sort of we had a pretty challenging environment when COVID hit and managed to get the support of our lender group to give us amendments to the documents that were required to get through that. So, look, I think Sydney's a bit of an evolving situation, right? We're all going to see how long the lockdown lasts, but I think we're in a much stronger position now because the liquidity we're going into this lockdown is much stronger than we had last time. The capital requirements are significantly lower as well. Last time we still had quite a lot of equity investments going into Queen's Wharf and finishing off some major CapEx projects. So, you know, we're going into this lockdown in Sydney sort of in a better position from a liquidity position. Talk to some of the asset sales as well that give even stronger support to that. But, you know, obviously, as if the lockdown continues to be extended, you know, we'll need to start to have discussions to get support. But there's nothing sitting here today that suggests to us that the lender group won't be supportive as they have been in the past.
Well, the, you know, the USPP success, it's a small program, but the fact that that's progressed during the lockdowns gives you a sense that, particularly the longer term, debt investors are seeing through this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Justin Barrett with CLSA. Please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Thanks very much for your time. I just wanted to ask, you noted the solid performance or the quite positive performance of the sovereign room despite the restrictions. I just wanted to ask if you could provide any indication of what you think the uplift could be if there was no restrictions from that sovereign room.
The sovereign room has a physical capacity of 800 to 1,000 people. We've been running it essentially for most of the year at 300 people because of COVID restrictions. The reason why we sized up the sovereign room so much is because we know that at the top end of our customer base, our guests like to bring friends and other people in to play with, and it's actually the most straightforward way of organically expanding the customer base. And so that's why we created a lot of, a beautiful bar, balconies, restaurants, probably one or two even more of that in the future, to create a club-like atmosphere for them to enjoy themselves. We've only scratched the surface of all of that because of the COVID restrictions. So I think, we can do very substantially better. Now, in table games, we've seen very good pickup. We're very happy with the expansion of the business that we've seen. We still think that there is untapped potential in Sydney that hopefully we'll get to when we reopen. And then in slots, we've had good performance. We're very happy with the performance of the slots product. And, we've probably can do a little bit better there, but I think the big upside for us is on tables.
Great. Thanks very much for that. And then I just wanted to just double check, is there any major update on the Sydney development opportunity over the last few months?
Yes. We have dropped from the seventh circle of hell to the eighth. For all of you who follow Dante, look, it's been a very difficult process. We are now in a process that seeks to develop a master plan and for Pyrmont with a sub-precinct master plan for our site. That process hopefully will go to exhibition by October of this year, and then commentary will be processed, and hopefully once the new guidelines have been developed, development guidelines have been developed, we can then sit down and see what we can physically develop against those guidelines. As you may recall, we've had two towers that we were contemplating to undertake, one at the sports bar end of the property, the other one basically opposite the property on Union Street. That second site has now been earmarked as a metro station with all the positives and negatives that come with that. The positives are, of course, that in the fullness of time, this is a fantastic development for us to get a metro station with rapid access into the CBD and rapid access into Western Sydney. Within 10, 12 minutes is fantastic and will open up a big market for us. The downside is
you know, that's a few years out, and the development will become a lot more complex with car parking impossible because there's a metro station there, and so we're currently discussing with government what we can and can't do on that side. So I don't want to go much further on that one. The most prospective site is still the, you know, the former Ritz-Carlton hotel development site, which I think in the master plan is sort of set up at 110 meters height. That would be a nice hotel, but no apartment on that site. So we'll see how we go with that one.
Thanks very much for that. Really appreciate it.
So we're clocking up 6 years now on that. And in the meantime, we've built, you know, three quarters of Queen's Wharf, and we're, you know, a couple of hotel towers in the Gold Coast, with a third one on the way.
Thanks again.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Beckier for closing remarks.
Thank you, operator. Thank you again for your interest and your support. And I see many of you, I think, individually over the next couple of days. If there's any unanswered questions, please reach out to Harry or Mark so we can follow up on that. But thank you for your interest and support through this difficult period. Take care. Bye.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.